sport.
The Pat Kenny Show
with the Jaguar E-Pace. Beautiful by design and dynamic to drive. Delivering performance that is unmistakably Jaguar.
This is News Talk.
Well, this is what Boris Johnson, or some of what he had to say last evening.
From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home, because the critical thing we must do to stop the disease spreading between households. That is why people will only be allowed to leave their home for the following very limited purposes. Shopping for basic necessities as infrequently as possible. One form of exercise a day, for example, a run, walk or cycle, alone or with members of your household. Any medical need to provide care or to help a vulnerable person. And travelling to and from work, but only where this is absolutely necessary and cannot be done from home. That's all. These are the only reasons you should leave your home. You should not be meeting friends. If your friends ask you to meet, you should say no. You should not be meeting family members who do not live in your home. You should not be going shopping except for essentials like food and medicine. And you should do this as little as you can. And use food delivery services where you can. If you don't follow the rules, the police will have the powers to enforce them, including through fines and dispersing gatherings.
So that was Boris Johnson addressing the nation last night. Well, the political editor with the Financial Times, George Parker, is on the line. George, good morning.
Morning.
They sound draconian on the face of it. The enforceability is something else. And looking at pictures of the London Underground today, social distancing still not characterised on that service.
No, I mean, these are the sort of measures that Boris Johnson has been resisting introducing for a few weeks. He didn't like the idea of the police being out asking people where they were going, of putting very draconian restrictions on people going out. So, yes, for Boris Johnson, this was a big step. And, I think most of the coverage in the British media today says this is a very draconian step, not seen in peacetime. However, as you say, there are still a lot of people out and about, and there's a particular problem on the London Underground where key workers are being asked to still go to work, people like healthcare workers, for example, but they're being asked to go to work on a much reduced public transport system. And as a result, in the rush hour, you've got people looking into each other's armpits, crammed together on tube carriages at the same time the rest of the country has been told to stay at home.
So that's the bizarre thing. By reducing the service, they've just forced more people into the service. Whereas if they'd kept the ordinary service going, even though many of the trains would be empty and they might feel that they could save on drivers' time and all of that by keeping them at home and even their own personal safety, the effect of that has been to concentrate people into the petri dish of infection.
Exactly. I mean, there's obviously an operational issue for London Transport, which is how do you keep normal service running when your own staff, of course, are self-isolating and all the rest of it. But nevertheless, it was a deliberate policy decision to run down the public transport system because they wanted to discourage people from travelling into London. But nevertheless, there are still some people who have to go to work, and there's a long list of so-called key workers who include, obviously, teachers who are keeping schools open for some children. You've got even journalists are covered on the list, actually, of people who are helping to cover the coronavirus. There's still lots of people who still need to get to work.
At the same time, the impression is given, certainly by those pictures which are going around the world, is that many more people are going to work than maybe in theory should need to go to work. I mean, homework, he said, only go to work if you can't work from home.
Yeah, certainly you're right, Pat, to draw attention to the pictures on the London Underground in the rush hour. But I don't think that should disguise the fact that for a large part of Britain today, it looks like the whole place is closed down. So, for example, the place I've been working this week, the House of Commons, is virtually deserted. I mean, there are a few MPs knocking around. Most journalists are working from home. And I think most people are taking the advice quite seriously. And I think the main criticism of Boris Johnson so far is that he hasn't taken this kind of action early enough. But as you say, there are still plenty of people who are deemed to be key workers who are still being asked to go to work in difficult situations.
The whole push for herd immunity, which was the early idea in Britain, that if enough people got the infection fairly quickly, herd immunity would develop and therefore life could come back to normal much more quickly. There was a quotation from attributed to Dominic Cummings in the Sunday Times on Sunday, I'm sure you saw it, where he was talking about this was the way to go, and so what if a few pensioners die?
Yeah, I mean, that comment was denied categorically by Number 10 and said it was defamatory and hadn't been checked with them. And subsequently, the journalist said it was a sort of someone sort of summarising what Dominic Cummings' attitude was rather than something he'd actually said. So I think it's to put that proviso in there. But your general point about this whole idea of herd immunity is correct, which is a completely mad idea, certainly from a political point of view. The idea that Britain was going to pursue its own course of action on tackling coronavirus, which was totally at odds with everything that was being done in other European countries, including Ireland, Belgium and France, all our neighbours. And for Britain to be even contemplating something which the chief scientific advisor, Patrick Vallance, said, which was that two-thirds of the population, 40 million people, might be infected in the interests of acquiring this population or herd immunity. The whole thing was a total PR disaster. Just the expression herd immunity obviously was designed to annoy people, but it was hard to see, even if the scientific advice was that it was a good idea, it was almost impossible to see how the politicians thought you could explain a policy which involved 40 million people being infected, with death rates in the UK rising far above those in other countries where much more tough suppression measures were being adopted, on the basis that later in the year the virus might not come back because the population was immune. I mean, how could you possibly have explained that your grandmother was dying on a hospital floor in these circumstances on the basis, oh, well, it might save a few lives further down the line? It was just completely unworkable.
Now, on a positive side, the kind of economic measures and fiscal measures being introduced seem, I mean, in shorthand, they're going to throw money at this.
Yeah, it's a pretty big economic package. They claim that it's among the best in the world in terms of economic support. And I think the UK government's learnt a lot from the financial crisis. You basically just have to throw money at it and suck it up, basically. And it's a very big package. There are some gaps in it, particularly around the self-employed. But generally, you know, it's a big thing. I mean, essentially, the heart of it is the government preparing to underwrite 80% of the wages of people who can't work because of the crisis over a three-month period. I guess that might have to be extended. A big pumping up of the welfare state, business rate holidays, and a massive package of government-backed cheap loans amounting to a total of £330 billion. So it's a very big package indeed. Whether it's going to be enough to stop the country slipping into a deep recession, I think, is another question.
All right. Well, we shall see how that works out. But the whole idea is to keep that link between employees and employer by making sure there's money in their pockets, and maybe the employer can cough up the deficit so that nobody actually suffers a reduction in what they take home. And then when we get the green light for the economy, off it goes full speed, because there won't be any need for recruitment and all the rest of it. Everyone will be in place. George, look, thank you very much. We will obviously keep in touch over the weeks and months as to how the various strategies are going. That's George Parker, political editor with the Financial Times. Well, we're going to get the latest from Germany now. Berlin correspondent with Euronews, Jessica Salz, is on the line. Jessica, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, Germany is doing what Germany hates to do, and that is running a deficit.
Absolutely. We've seen both the economy and the finance ministers, most recently yesterday, but also in the past couple of weeks, really promising to loosen Germany's purse strings quite a lot. The rescue package they've put in place to try and really stave off the devastating effects of the coronavirus on the German economy is going to total some €756 billion. And it's really quite a broad package. Within this, they plan to help everyone from the self-employed. They plan to help benefits, people on benefits, boost the healthcare system, and also help businesses really small and large with this.
This reluctance to borrow is something not alone in the German government, but in the German psyche, but needs must. And what are they saying about the impact of that borrowing from presumably the European Central Bank at zero interest rates? What's it going to do to the German economy? Inflate the economy, which would, I think, given the history of the last few years, be no bad thing.
Well, I think what we're really seeing at the moment is that these are emergency measures. As you quite rightly said, this is neither the German government nor the Germans themselves really like to spend. But this is, as you say, needs must. The 156 billion of this is going to come from German borrowing itself. And then they're also going to be a stability mechanism within the German state bank. But really, we're not seeing a lot, at least not hearing a lot from the government about whether this, what kind of inflation this could lead to further down the line. As I said, this really is at the moment we're talking about propping up the German economy. I think really the German government has learned from not spending, especially in the recession in 2008-2009, which the current situation is being compared to, where there was a reluctance to spend and we saw a lot of people suffer there. Whereas we're really hearing from the government now is that no job is going to be lost through the coronavirus and no company is going to go under. I think the government, as I said, has really learned their lesson, really realised that they have to spend in order that companies don't go bust and people don't lose their jobs.
Now, are there even plans announced to what will happen post the corona crisis? Because, you know, Germany, although we know it's a fabulous country with a terrific infrastructure, there is still the need to rebuild some of that infrastructure. Are they talking about that now?
There's not much talk about what will happen after the corona crisis yet, it must be said. And I think this is because it's such an unprecedented situation here in Germany, as elsewhere in Europe and elsewhere in the world. Of course, this is an economy that's based on exporting. And so the real problem for Germany at the moment is that a lot of its export markets are either closed to it or really drying up. I mean, for example, China is a really, really important market for German cars. Well, of course, they're not buying many cars at the moment. Neither are other countries. And Volkswagen, as well as other German car manufacturers, have closed down a lot of their operations at the moment. A lot of their parts to even make the cars come from China. But as I said, this we're living in a really unprecedented time. Nobody really knows how long this thing is going to last. It's very difficult to predict even what's going to happen next week, let alone in a few months' time.
And finally, Jessica, in terms of meeting the medical challenge, how is Germany doing?
Germany is doing well. It's got a very robust and well-funded healthcare system, and it is one that is decentralized because this is a federal country. And that has meant that all of Germany's 16 federal states have actually been able to react very quickly to coronavirus cases that they have had on local and regional levels. And I think that's why one of the reasons why Germany's death rate from the coronavirus is currently much lower than other countries. They've got a lot more of the requisite respiratory equipment that's needed to treat patients who are suffering from the coronavirus. And they're spending a lot of money in it on the health system. They're going to be spending billions on the health system and doubling the number of ICU beds from 28,000 to 56,000 over the coming weeks. So they're really trying to prepare for this, but we're also seeing the number of coronavirus cases going up in Germany. Another 4,800 were announced this morning. This was since yesterday, taking the number currently up to over 27,000. Although the health system here is better prepared than perhaps other European countries, it is already starting to feel the strain.
Jessica Saltz, the Euronews correspondent for Berlin, thank you very much for joining us. Well, we're heading stateside now. Much of the United States is in some form of shutdown or even lockdown in some areas. But US President Donald Trump says the plan is to get the country going again as soon as possible.
This is not a country that was built for this. It was not built to be shut down. America will again and soon be open for business, very soon, a lot sooner than 3 or 4 months that somebody was suggesting, a lot sooner. We cannot let the cure be worse than the problem itself. We're not going to let the cure be worse than the problem, because we have it pretty well shut down in order to get rid of this invisible enemy. So, yeah, it's bad. And it's going to, obviously, the numbers are going to increase with time, and then they're going to start to decrease. And we're going to be opening our country up for business because our country was meant to be open.
Well, managing editor with the WSHU Public Radio, Terry Sheridan, is joining me on the line. Terry, good morning.
And good morning to you, Pat.
Now, there is some politicking going on with this package, which is a huge package. Maybe before we hear about the politics of all of this, what's on offer?
Well, right now it's a $2 trillion stimulus bill. It would provide nearly $1,200 to every American taxpayer, basically every American adult who pays taxes or responsible for taxes, $500 for every child. It would also create an $850 billion loan program that would go to businesses, states, and municipalities. This would be run by the Treasury Department or overseen by the Treasury Department. That is the major sticking point because Democrats are saying, wait a minute, the way this is set up, this is just basically a slush fund for business. There's no accountability. Republicans say they need flexibility, and they accuse Democrats of trying to put in some pork barrel or put in special projects there. So they're still negotiating the package. It should be, or the what word we're getting is that they're close to a deal, and maybe something will be announced early this morning here in the States.
Yeah, you might explain to us why the Republicans who have a majority in the Senate can't just run it through.
Well, two reasons. One, because of the rules of the Senate, in effect, you need close to 60 votes to pass anything because of the filibuster rule. Now, I say close to 60 votes because there are five members of the Senate who are missing. One has Senator Rand Paul has the coronavirus, and another is in self-quarantine because her husband has the virus. So the numbers are kind of off. But yes, you need a supermajority in the Senate to get anything done.
And the Democrats are fearful that Republicans will simply look after their own, the companies that support the Republican Party. How would that actually work if a federal agency is actually dispersing the funds?
Well, that is, well, the devil's in the details, and that's what Democrats want to see. They want to see more of how the oversight is going to run instead of just being, I guess, loose. They're fearful of what happened in 2008 with bailout packages then, which is basically a blank check to businesses, many of whom who bought back their own stock instead of investing in the company or investing in the workers. The Democrats want more money to go directly to American citizens, whether it's in the cash payout, whether it's in unemployment insurance payments, whether it's in forgiveness of student loans, etc. The Republicans, why they have some of that in their package, they say that the money needs to go to businesses, especially the businesses that are suffering the most, such as the airlines, the automakers, that have laid off, I would say, millions of people across the country just in the past week.
Now, I think you told us the other day, Terry, that the business of unemployment payments comes down to the states rather than the federal government. How mixed is it across the country? I mean, if someone is laid off, what kind of income support might they get from the states and for how long?
Well, usually for the states, and this is a pretty general rule across across the country, it's not long. It's probably anywhere up to 26 weeks, half a year. After that, there are other programs, other welfare programs that could be available. But it all depends on how, quote unquote, liberal the state is. In New York and Connecticut and the Northeast region of the United States, more liberal policies, higher payouts, obviously. But it's up to each state to run, and each state manages, and each state has their own money for it.
But might it be half of what they would be paid, or what way does it work? Is it more subsistence than that?
No, it's not. It's based on a percentage. So, and again, I'm just making this, rounding this number off. Just say you make $1,000 a week, you might only see $400 or $500 a week. It all depends on various income things that you have in your house. If your spouse continues to work, it's a very subjective number. It is not, definitely not 100% of what you would make if you were working.
And finally, Terry, the handling of the whole crisis by the president, you know, America's meant to be open. How dare this virus dare to close our country kind of thing. And he's taking upon himself, you know, prescribing medicines like the anti-malarial medicines and all of this. How's he doing?
How is he doing politically, or how is he doing overall managing
the job? How is he perceived to be doing, shall we say, by the public?
If first of all, if you like the president, you think he's doing a good job. If you saw the response last night from Republicans and conservatives, it's like finally someone who's speaking the truth. The message is, as we just heard in the clip, is that, well, you know what? People are going to die. We can't help that, but we got to make it better. Other people and more people are feeling this way. It's like, wait a minute, this is something that we have to take very seriously. It's not going to be over in 15 days. We don't know how long it's going to be over, but, you know, hey, slow down. You know, everyone's been telling everyone to social distance, stay home. And now you're saying maybe we're going to open up in the beginning of April. So it's still a very politically divisive time. Those who support the president say it's time to move on. You know, we'll do our best. Those who are, I would say the majority of Americans are just saying, wait a minute, let's try to keep as normal as possible. But this is something that if it overwhelms the healthcare system is going to be a disaster.
And lastly, online yesterday, seeing lots of postings of military movements across the United States, you know, long freight trains with military vehicles, Humvees on the back, convoys and convoys of military vehicles heading towards Chicago. Are they just simple routine movements, or is there something else going on?
There's something else going on, but it's not as sinister it might appear. For instance, here in New York, the National Guard has been activated. So they are in the process of building field hospitals at four locations in the metropolitan New York City area. They're also working to help the state police and local police in their chores as the virus, you know, also affects them. I mean, New York City police have been affected. So, yes, they're here to help, but it's not anything sinister, so to speak.
All right, Terry, thank you very much for joining us. And that is Terry Sheridan, Managing Editor of WSHU Public Radio. Dan O'Brien, Chief Economist with the Institute of International and European Affairs and columnist with Independent Newspapers, is joining us now. Dan's been listening to all those conversations. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, the Germans, the Americans, the Brits are throwing money at the problem, and it's kind of live now, pay later. Is that what we should be doing?
Absolutely. This is an emergency. It's unprecedented. The policy response will be unprecedented, and we're seeing that around the world.
So in terms of what you would expect a sensible government to announce today in the economic package, what would you expect to see?
Well, there'll be two sort of main planks. One is personal income supports, so that people, that alleviates hardship. There are clearly going to be, and there have already been, many, many layoffs, tens of thousands of layoffs, particularly in the hospitality sector, which will be the one that is worst affected. So the government will boost incomes for people who've lost jobs. So that's on the personal level. Then for businesses, the key part of this will be to keep as many businesses going as possible. And central to that will be preventing businesses from running up debts. While businesses have much less money coming in, if they run up big debts, that could push them into an insolvency position. We want to preserve as many businesses as possible so that when we can get back to work, those businesses can come out of hibernation. So that's an absolutely central part of this, and these are one of the lessons.
And that's something that
China already.
Yeah, the tarnish has signaled that the link between employers and employees would be maintained. So that suggests some sort of subsidizing of people who are not doing any work, but who still want to remain linked to the company.
Let's just also say, Pat, you know, people are extremely innovative. Organizations are extremely innovative. If people remain on in their jobs and they're being paid, they're not going to be doing nothing. People are going to be thinking about how to do things. For example, we at the Institute of International and European Affairs are saying, you know, what can we do to change how we do our business? Usually our main focus is having meetings, physical meetings, where people come and discuss with experts. So we're looking at ways we can do that online, through webinars and different ways. So, you know, don't underestimate the capacity for people to innovate and do things differently. You know, you were talking about the construction sector earlier. You know, to what extent will construction workers change the way they work so they can continue to work? You know, the same goes for production lines. The same goes for farmers. You know, again, an area where I see very little impact in employment, because we're all going to eat the same amount. So the agriculture sector, 100,000 people at work there, should be very little. The effect on that sector should be very limited.
How much help will we get from Europe to pay our bills?
You know, the Europe doesn't really have a role in this, with one exception. The European Central Bank is our central bank. In times of emergency and crisis, banks have to be willing to print money. Now, printing money is not a good idea. We all know if central banks print money, you can end up like Germany in the 1930s or Venezuela today. So printing money is not a good option, but it needs to be done in emergency situations. At midnight last Wednesday night, the ECB came out and said that it was prepared to print quite a lot of money, and that it will print even more if necessary, which means that wonderfully this morning, the Irish government can borrow at less than 0.33% for 10 years. And that's very stable. So it's really important that the ECB performs its role as the lender of last resort to allow European governments to borrow huge amounts. They're going to have to borrow, and that's an unfortunate reality. There's going to be a big bill for this, but we're in an emergency. All the normal rules are suspended. Governments are going to have to step in and act as in ways they haven't done. This is an emergency. This needs to happen.
Dan O'Brien, thank you very, very much for joining us. Now, still to come, now that we're spending more time at home,